This is Rahimi and Harris on 670 The Score. We thank Mark Grody and Chuck Swirsky for coming in and helping out with the coverage of the celebration of life for Ryan Sandberg that was just held in Chicago. Some somber moments, some appreciated moments when it came to some levity to break up the sadness, and then also wonderful stories told by those closest to him regarding his life and how he made people feel. And I think that it was important for us as a station at The Score to be able to bring that to you, because we know a lot of people are grieving. And so I hope that it brought people some peace. Even though we can't bring Ryan Sandberg back, we can still have the memories and appreciate them in this way. So I hope it did that a little bit for you today.
Just a wonderful job and tribute by all involved, starting with Father Thomas Hurley and his ability to really not just navigate through the impact that Ryan Sandberg had on so many people, but demonstrating how he was a man of service through both personal anecdotes and just telling stories as they had been told to him. And then we had a host of speakers. You mentioned Bob Costas, his agent Jimmy Turner, his daughter Lindsay Newton, his son Justin Sandberg, the Sandberg grandkids stepping up and giving their words in honor of their poppy. That's P-A-P-P-I, not P-A-P-P-Y. Just a great job done, and a shout out to the Cubs and the way they handled this with the Gallagher Way viewing for anybody that wanted to go see it on the big screen with a sense of community, as it was a private service that was held, but also being encouraged to bring non-perishable items. It all seemed to be in that spirit of who Ryan Sandberg was, who I knew him to be personally, as not just a baseball man, but also as a person.
And for me, I think one of the moments that really was emotional, and I think Father Hurley did a wonderful job, was when he gave the story about Ryan and Margaret renewing their vows so late toward the end of his life, and then also the baptism of their grandson, Roman. And that was the part for me where I was moved to tears. And there were many tearful moments, whether it was Bob Costas talking about his memory, and then also at the end talking about what Ryan Sandberg meant to the fans and those memories staying with him, and now he gets to stay with you.
With Ryan, I thought the message that should really stay with everyone from this is something that Father Hurley said at the end of his homily in terms of Ryan Sandberg and what he believed. Quote, faith, family, friends, and love, that's all you need. And there's so much truth to that. Sometimes you forget how simple life in its actuality is until a moment like this, and it all brings things into a degree of clarity, because we all have so much going on, but we stop. Rarely do we stop in this life, but we stop at a moment like this honoring a legend such as Ryan Sandberg.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I wrote down as well, the faith, family, friends, and love. And if I guess there's something you take from it today, that would be something that I will certainly take moving forward. I also appreciated what Bob Costas had to say when it came to bringing up the Sandberg game relatively early in his eulogy, when he talked about how it had created a 4-decade connection between Ryan and him. And he pointed out the pose in his statue where he is looking on and being respectful and being ready, not finishing through a home run, for example, the hero pose, as Costas called it. And he narrates and evaluates these moments so well, as he has in his entire career. But to be able to speak in these moments, and also even adding levity with the Yogi Berra quote about go to your friends' funerals because who's coming to your own? I thought that was appreciated as well.
Deep stuff being echoed, the sentiment, by so many different people. And it's great just to hear so many people gathering and on the same page for such an event as this. And, you know, Ryan Sandberg, because we knew he wasn't doing well, and because his passing happened and we celebrated his life then, and this seemed like a great cap to it all, but with the understanding that his memory certainly will live on, and an understanding of how much respect everyone, not just Cubs fans, but everyone whether it was baseball, whether it was you're just a Chicagoan, you can be a White Sox fan and appreciate the greatness of a quote-unquote rival.
which Father Hurley did well with explaining the sashes that were so beautifully made and given, and then how his had a custom White Sox logo.
Just a little something to remind people. I am still from the South Side. I still do cheer for the Sox.
I was going to say sports is community in
yes.
its purest form, and it should be a celebration of many people's lives. And sometimes all you have left are the moments, and what we are remembering the most is how he made you feel. And that's what's most important today. So we thank you for joining us for the remembrance of Ryan Sandberg, as we will continue to do, of course, every day here on The Score. And I hope that that did bring some peace to some people and at least help them through this process. Coming up next, we are going to continue our show here from Las Vegas. We are live at Circa Resort and Casino. Marshall Harris and I, Ray Diaz, our producer as well, Tyler Farengel working with us back at the station. And once again, thank you to you. And also thank you to Marquee Sports Network for making this possible, as we were able to help broadcast the service through them, and to Chuck Swirsky and Mark Grody for helping us through this as well. More from Rahimi and Harris live from Las Vegas next on The Score.
It's time for Five on. Layla Rahimi and Marshall Harris bring you five topics on their minds today on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
I got five on.
Five on It is our noon segment. We do it every day. We are broadcasting live from Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. We are at Stadium Swim in a cabana, because it's a tough life over here, as we get ready for Circa's football contest weekend.
Number one.
All right, number one on Five on It. Which Bears player has the most at stake in tonight's preseason finale against the Chiefs?
I feel like it's got to be one of the running backs, right? Or perhaps the four-person log jam to figure out who's going to play swing tackle. I don't think it's Ozzie Trapillo, because you don't do that to the second-round pick who's a rookie. So is it perhaps even a guy like Theo Benedet, who didn't make the team last year in the same manner and is back fighting for his keep and showed such great improvement? It really is about depth in these types of games when it comes to pressure, with the cutdown day being on Tuesday. So I think that might be the case. It might be a guy like Ian Wheeler. It might be a guy like Theo Benedet, trying to figure out how they fit into a team that has a lot of backups in certain positions in the position rooms.
Listen, you had the right position. I think you had the wrong player. It's Karan Amagaji, because he's not being offered the grace that maybe he deserves, but you are entitled nothing in the NFL. It stands for not for long. It could be really short for him. A guy that was a third-round pick a year ago and couldn't go through his rookie training camp the way he wanted to because he was injured when he was drafted. And now all of a sudden he looks around and is like, man, y'all got a whole lot more offensive tackles that are in here, including a guy that came in when I came in and he wasn't even drafted. Now he's getting more reps than me with the big boys. It's Karan Amagaji with a bullet. He'd better go out there, not get blown by when he's out there with the twos or the threes or whoever he ends up out there with, because it won't be the ones. Karan Amagaji, he has no margin for error. It's all on him, and I can't wait to see what he does in this last stand, if you will, in Kansas City.
There's a bunch of third-round picks, and I say that knowing the Bears didn't have any third-round picks this year.
Very convenient.
There's a bunch of third-round picks who really have to earn their keep this season, if they're even staying on the team. You know, we had a Zach Pickens sighting in the games in the preseason.
Not a sighting.
But that's how I felt about it. Like, I want to see how Dennis Allen uses him as well, but, man, I feel like these are the rounds, the third, fourth, and fifth are where you build your team depth. That's really where you can make some hay, because let's face it, the guy who's probably starting at left tackle is a fifth round pick, for example. You need to play the players that you draft. That's the bottom line. I don't care at what point you begin your team. Those guys should be on the field, kind of like Jaquan Brisker, Kyler Gordon. So when it comes to the rounds 3, 4, and 5 with this team, I'm absolutely paying attention here.
Five on it. Number two.
What did you make of these comments from Dolphins guard Aaron Brewer?
That first joint practice with Chicago, I feel like they were like some BS, you know what I'm saying? Because they was out there tackling and this and that. So it was like fake physicality, you know what I'm saying? Like, if we, they out there playing tackle football and everybody else was out there playing like 7-on-7 or something, like, it's fake physicality. And you kind of seen that when we went out there and played in a real game.
What'd you think of what Dolphins guard Aaron Brewer had to say about the Bears, Layla and Marshall?
So, Layla, here's what's beautiful about this. I love it because it sounds like he was on a different program than the one that the Bears were on, and the Bears were more physical than the Dolphins were. And that's perfect if you're the Bears, because guess what? For the last how many years we've been like, why can't they be more physical? Offense, defense. The battle is won up front in the trenches. And what I've seen this year tells me that this team is as prepared as any team that I've seen the Bears maybe in the last decade as far as physicality up front, whether it's the addition of all the veterans. When you talk about guys like Drew Dahlman, Joe Tooney, Josiah Jackson, you can go down the list, right? And understanding Grady Jarrett exists, Dabo Odingbo, you have expectations that you haven't had. And I think it's good to set the tone by being quote-unquote over the top or fake tough. Doesn't matter what the Dolphins think. All that matters is what the Bears think and what their mentality is going in the regular season.
Well, I also think if there was an expectation as far as what it was going to be mutually agreed upon between these two teams, shouldn't that have been discussed at some point prior to the practice? I understand that thud is the term that people use a lot rather than actual tackling. How do you describe thud in the NFL to the players? You think they might all have a different opinion of what that could be? So that's where I sit with this. Is this sounds like something that was preventable if it needed to be, which I don't necessarily know that it did. But if it was truly a difference in communication and expectation, then where was the communication breakdown? That's what I'm trying to figure out. I'm even going to look past Dennis Allen's history as coordinator and the vast career resume that he has. I say that with a smile. But when it comes to if there was some sort of understanding as to what that should have been, then why wasn't that relayed to everybody? I have respect for Brewer. He went to a high school that does not play around. I remember one year they had 17 Division I athletes out of a single football class. So I understand the respect that goes on mutually among teammates and among players in the NFL, but something seems like there just wasn't a... I don't think the whole team played dirty. I feel like there was some sort of communication breakdown.
But also, on top of that, Layla, if it starts off and you realize, oh, this is more physical than we expect, why don't you step up and match that physicality? That's my point. It's a joint practice. We're used to joint practices getting out of hand and being a little too much. I think that's perfectly fine and acceptable, especially since it was the first joint practice for either of those teams, and they both had another joint practice coming the following week.
Five on it. Number three.
This is 5 on it on 670 The Score with Layla Rahimi and Marshall Harris live at the beautiful Stadium Swim at Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. Before we get to question number three, we're going to tell you about something we're giving away today. Keep listening for your chance to win a pair of tickets to see the Cubs versus Washington at Wrigley Field on Sunday, September 7th. It's all provided by Bosch Power Tools. The more you Bosch, the more you feel like a Bosch. Here's the question. How much do you put Thursday's Cubs loss to the Brewers on Craig Counsell's lineup card?
A lot. A lot, because I know who started that game, and one mistake by Shota Imanaga, even though the Brewers ultimately scored four runs, should not be the difference maker. And I feel like I say that all the time with this offense that can't produce, but guess what happened? The offense couldn't produce. We saw the same issues. The Cubs managed four hits total. Total. I mean, that's when it becomes absolutely frustrating. I'm sorry, it was five hits total. Forgive me. But the point is, overall for the series, and I found this number two, and it's disturbing. Do you know what Cubs batters hit against Milwaukee pitching in the entire five-game series?
I guarantee you it was well below the Mendoza line.
It was 187.
Yeah, that's
below
the Mendoza line.
They had five hits in the game. They were 0-for-8 with runners in scoring position. The player who was a hero for you the day before, who you decided was going to be a major part of this team from game one of the year as a rookie, you decided to sit for reasons I don't entirely understand. And then the rookie who had been the difference maker in Owen Casey, as I just mentioned, Matt Shaw, wasn't in the lineup until a very high leverage situation, because that's good for rookies. to put him in with runners at the corners and two outs in the eighth inning is a better move? That's the part I don't understand with the lineup construction and the how you used everybody after that.
I was hoping after I saw the lineup going into this game, I was like, maybe I'm wrong, the same way I was wrong for game one of the doubleheader, in which Willie Castro was in the lineup. There was no Nico Horner. And Willie Castro hit a bomb, and the Cubs won the game. I was like, maybe Craig Counsell has some kind of sixth sense that I'm not seeing here. And that's fine, because he's the manager of the Cubs. They pay him the big bucks, certainly more than they pay me to talk about Craig Counsell and his decisions. But no, I was right. 11 men left on base. 0 for 8 with runners in scoring position. Layla, in a game that they trailed 2-1 after the fifth inning, they had the leadoff man on in each of the final four innings. How many runs did they score?
Zero. And not just that, but there were leadoff men on via a walk, like the case in the eighth inning. And I didn't just mean to make an Owen Casey pun there, but if your leadoff man gets on via a walk and it's Pete Crow Armstrong, don't you assume something is happening there?
Yeah, you would think so. But the other thing I want to talk about is Matt Shaw. You don't want to move him up in the order. That's cool. But if you watch the game the night before in which Matt Shaw had the game-deciding home run, I just don't understand how in good conscience that's the game you decide to take him out of the lineup. The Kyle Tucker thing is something completely unrelated to Matt Shaw in that I don't know why he was in the lineup to begin with. But to reinsert him into the lineup, to watch those four bats that I watched, and to ask myself each time coming up, why is he still in the two hole? It's okay if you want to work him back in the lineup. Actually, that's a lie. It's not okay because you said a few days, and a few does not equal two, which is the number of days you actually gave him off. But to put him back in the lineup, right back in the two hole, it's okay to move him to the, I don't know, bottom third of the order, or even the middle third of the order if you want to bat him sixth. But to bat him two, and to see him and Seiya Suzuki go 0 for 8 combined, painful to watch.
Oh, I still need to look up Seiya Suzuki's weighted runs created plus number.
Let me tell you, that number is on the decline.
Five on it. Number four.
The Brewers have a 7-game lead on the Cubs in the NL Central with 34 games to play. Do the Cubs have a realistic chance of winning the division?
They did what they were supposed to do in that they got the tiebreaker. And there are times where they can't even count on that in previous seasons where I feel like it did absolutely make a difference as to whether or not they were going to make the playoffs. So they were able to, number one, get the series, number two, get the season series, which puts them in a better position than where they were at this time before that 5-game set began. As to whether or not they can take the division, I feel like the Brewers, in a way, were still acting like the underdogs, even though they have a massive lead in the Central. It's hard to say because even in the game you just saw yesterday, you see how that team is able to take advantage and then also how their pitching was able to, as we said, withstand a lot of early in the inning situations that seemed like they would fall in favor of the Cubs, whether it's walking the leadoff batter, whether it's the leadoff batter in the inning getting on base somehow. They're able to withstand it all. I can't say that about the Cubs. I can't say that about the rest of the teams in the NL Central. So it's going to be a very hard argument to make. But the good news is at least the Cubs were able to get the tiebreaker. It may come down to that if they have a chance to win this division.
You want the pro or the con first in this discussion?
Whichever you think is the best.
Okay. Let me give you the sobering news first. If the Brewers, with 34 games left, simply go .500 the rest of the way, which they are fully capable of, 17-17. That would put them at 97-65. 97 wins. For the Cubs to match them, which is all they have to do, get to 97 wins, they would need to go 23-11 the rest of the way. That's better than winning two out of every three games. That's the bar which they would need to go. That's only if the Brewers play minimal .500 baseball. That's how the Cubs would have to do to catch them. That is the bad news, because I don't expect the Brewers to play .500 baseball. I expect them to be higher than .500. Here's the good news if you're a Cubs fan wondering if the division could possibly still be within reach. The Cubs have 34 games left, and they have, out of 30 teams, the 30th remaining strength of schedule in baseball. Their opponents from here on out have a .458 winning percentage. Looking ahead, they play seven of those last 34 games against teams with winning records. And when I tell you the two teams, you're going to be like, oh, it's the Reds and the Mets. Four against the Reds, three against the Mets. And we know how the Mets have looked since the trade deadline, since the All-Star break. Not good.
Yeah, that's the other one, though. I feel like they're two similar teams in similar situations where you're wondering when the bleeding stops.
So there is a path when you have three games against the Rockies and three games with the Nationals and three games with the Pirates and six games with the Atlanta Braves. Depends on how the Atlanta Braves, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde feel that week. And then three with the Giants and three with the Tampa Bay Rays. This nine-game road trip upcoming will have a lot to do with if they can make that happen. They need to go 7-2. 6-3 is not good enough. I'm going to start with that. They need to go 7-2 on this upcoming road trip. The other thing that's the X factor is, has Craig Counsell finally learned the lesson? Because yesterday he told me he had not. You got to be able to shuffle that lineup around, and you can't let Kyle Tucker's wants to play override the need of the team to be able to produce from 1-9.
Five on it. Number five.
Final question on Five on It here on 670 The Score with Layla Rahimi and Marshall Harris live at the beautiful Stadium Swim, which features every sport imaginable playing across several TV screens and their giant here over the pool here at Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. Here is our question. Would you rather give up your favorite food or your favorite song for the rest of your life?
Yeah, it's a tough one. This is the question that came to mind last night as I was walking back to my hotel room after the beautiful dinner with you, Ray, with you, Layla, with our guy, Mitch Rosen. And we had these pierogies that had lobster in them. Technically, I'm not supposed to eat lobster. It's a shellfish. But I was like, let me just try it. Because I was going to just try a little piece of the pierogi. It was so delicious. I ate like two whole pierogies. And I was like, it's hard to give up stuff like this. But I've done a good job of not eating that stuff because I'm not supposed to have it. I think I would have to give up my favorite song. I think the song is the way to go because there's probably a chance that that artist has other music that you really, really love. Or there's a song that kind of gives you the same vibe. But the food thing, man, it's hard to give up your favorite food. What do you say, Layla?
I thought about it, but then again, I'm like, I don't really have a ton of favorite foods because I like so much food.
So give up a food?
Yeah, because I feel... No, actually, let me finish.
Oh, okay.
So I thought about it. I don't necessarily have a specific favorite food. But I also really don't have a favorite song. I like so much music that I feel like I would be fine. I would find something else to cure the need because, frankly, I listen to so much music that it's not an issue. So what I realized is I just consume too much.
Both musically and in as far as food goes?
Yeah, there's not a doubt. Like, I probably know the name of, like, 4 out of every 5 songs they're playing, if not, like, 9 out of 10.
You miss your karaoke era.
No, I'm not a karaoke person necessarily, but I just know the songs when I hear them. So I think it's still the song for me because songs don't always satisfy like your food does. Like the song doesn't cure hanger. So I think it's probably favorite song because I'll come up with a new one later.
What's your favorite song?
I can't think of a specific. I'd have to look at the playlist and what I've been playing the most recently to see.
Wow. Okay.
That's how I feel about it. Like I don't absolutely have to have a song. Like I'll come up with something else, and so will art. So I don't really have to worry about it. Now the industrial complex is another story. But they also say like you get to a certain age and then you can't handle any more new music. Like that's a study that's been done. I am not to that age yet, which I feel good about.
That is a good thing. That's definitely a good thing. I don't like giving up the food thing. The song, I can give up one song. Because as you just said, new songs will be created. It's a lot easier to create a new song than it is a new flavor, per se. I've had a lot of flavors. And I feel like I'm across the rainbow on the flavors. The songs, there's always going to be a new song around the corner. That was number 5.
Now I feel like we've closed it out properly. Coming up next here on 670 The Score, Rahimi and Harris, as we broadcast live from Stadium Swim. And the music is going here. And right now we have a good look at the Tour Championship on the big screen. They had the Cubs game on Marquee live for us yesterday while we were at the pool. We have guests coming in as well because as part of Circus Football Contest Weekend, they have a lot of really cool panelists and a lot of really fun guests. So we stole one. One of the favorites of the midday show, Sam Munson, now of the 33rd team, a great football mind, will join us here live from the cabana at Stadium Swim to talk Bears, NFL news, and more. That is next on Raheem and Harris on The Score.
Layla Raheem, Marshall Harris, middays 10 a.m. to 2 on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
It's been a long time since the Bears have had an offense that fans could get excited about. Signs from the defense in recent years, but can they get the offense? Pretty good start to this one. It's another tight end in Cole Kmet. All the way out near the 45-yard line, a gain of 28.
Yeah, so take a look here. You got two high safeties. They're going to push, and he's just going to run right down, run a middle bender. Just runs right by the Mike linebacker, and that's something that they really are harping on with Caleb Williams. Last year, it was a lot of improv. It was a lot of playing off script. And that pass to Kmet, that back foot hits the ground. Ball is out on time, accurate. It allows for a lot of run after catch. That's really well executed there by Caleb Williams.
That was courtesy of Fox, and it was so nice to hear things like too high coverage being understood, Cole Kmet being involved in the offense. That was a welcome discussion from Joe Davis and Greg Olson. And that said, we are joined now by one of our favorite guests here on Midday Show on 670 The Score. This is Raheem and Harris broadcasting live from Circa Resort and Casino at Stadium Swim. It is Sam Munson of the 33rd team. He is on the Check the Mic podcast. Sam was at Bears practice last week, and your pool outfit is a W. Sam, I know you just said that you're not used to constant heat like this, but you dress perfectly.
Look, as an Irishman, we're not built for the sun. We're built for overcast, rain, you know, cold temperatures. So yeah, I'm experimenting now with a bit of sunshine.
It's right there, Sam. How long could you last in that sunshine here in Las Vegas?
With no hair, with the bald head being what it is, I think we've got about 48, 40, you know, 49 seconds before we're just
I thought you were going to say 48 minutes.
No. We're under a minute, definitely.
We'll get you a bucket hat and run you right out there.
So wait, what are you doing to brush off the melancholy weather, though? That's the key. I need to know that answer as well.
Well, that's the problem. Yeah, it's dreary. You know, my wife keeps wanting to move back to Dublin. I'm like, I don't want to go where, you know, 4 out of 5 days is raining.
All right. Okay.
Just take her to Seattle. She'll feel right at home.
Yeah, there you go. We're happy to talk to you, of course. And I know we just brought this up to you in the break. I think it's probably worth mentioning just out of the gate. The news about Brian Robinson, who was a discussion for, I think, a lot of Bears fans, because we're still trying to figure out their running back room.
Yeah.
Reports say he's going to the 49ers. Commanders do end up trading him running back. What do you think about that move? And do you think he also, based on what you've seen, could have fit in on the Bears?
Yeah, first and foremost, I think he would have been a good fit for the Bears. He's an interesting player. I kind of like Brian Robinson. I think he's a good football player. He's definitely a better running back for a gap type of scheme, you know, a power scheme, teams that like to pull offensive linemen. He's really good running in those systems. For whatever reason, the new regime in Washington didn't really like him that much. It makes sense. You know, they want to run more of a spread type of offense. They want to run a lot of those zone plays. So it kind of makes sense that he was dropping down that depth chart. From their point of view, getting a straight sixth-round draft pick for a guy that was probably going to get cut because of that is good business. Like, look at all the other trades that are happening right now. They're pick swaps, you know, whereas they got actually just a new draft pick, albeit a sixth. So it's good business from Washington's point of view. San Francisco being the team to bite, though, is kind of intriguing because we think of Kyle Shanahan's offense as, you know, a true zone type of system. Now, it's evolved over the last few years. They're running a lot more gap and power stuff than they did in the past. But still, this is supposed to be, you know, Christian McCaffrey redemption season, and yet they go and bring in a guy like Brian Robinson who wouldn't, you know, be an immediate automatic fit in that offense.
The running back position is so interesting because it's devalued by a lot of people, but then the special ones are special, and you're trying to figure that out. Clearly, Washington thought he was Jag, just another guy, and they didn't want to pay him what he was owed, and that makes perfect sense. I'm wondering, since you were at Bears practice last week and you understand their situation, Would you be comfortable with what they have in the running back room, knowing Ben Johnson's at the helm going into the regular season?
Yeah, I mean, you look at their practices, they don't seem to have a difference maker there, but I think they've got a lot of guys that can be productive. So, you know, this feels like a season where maybe they'll roll into the year with what they have. They'll see which of the guys kind of emerges and, you know, outperforms the other one. And then maybe next offseason they go looking for, like, a real alpha that can either propel this group forward or be the true number one in the backfield.
I think also I appreciate how you're able to not just fess up to some sins or like some miscues. I know you famously will always say, I liked Mitch Trubisky. You own that one. Is there any opinion you have of the Bears now that either makes you that way where you think, oh, something I thought previously isn't the case, whether it's Ben Johnson or what? But do you have something like that now after what you've seen both in a couple games and then the practice you observed?
No, I think it's just interesting watching them. Like, we were there for the Bills-Bears joint practice, and I think the Bears had the better of both sides of the ball during that practice. Their offense was definitely the better unit against Buffalo's defense. I think their defense was better than the Bills' offense as well. That one, though, felt a little bit like, you know, Josh Allen was just trying some stuff. Like, there were some throws he was making where it's like, I don't think Josh Allen even attempts that throw in the regular season. He was just seeing what he could get away with. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't get away with some of them. Like, Jaquan Brisker was everywhere in that practice. So, the Bears are going to be a fascinating team this year. Like, I think they have quite a broad range of outcomes. They could be with the best teams in that division, or they could still be the fourth best team in the division if it doesn't all come together quickly.
If it's not the Bears, who do you think the fourth best team in the division is? I'm fascinated by the way this division is going to play out.
I mean, you look at those things, and it's like, what are the odds of various things? The Vikings are the other team that have the biggest swing because it's all J.J. McCarthy. You know, if he's good, the Vikings could be as good as Detroit. They could be another 14-win team again. They've gotten better in a lot of different areas. If he's bad, though, they could be the worst team in the division. That's, you know, that's one player, if he's the quarterback, has that kind of power to swing the results.
What about the offense did you see? I know we just had the play, our producer Tyler played, of Cole Kmet. You know, and we know he was MIA last year, and I don't think that was his fault. What else about the Bears' offense did you like out of what you saw?
I think you're going to see a lot of two tight end formations for this team. I think you're going to see both those guys involved, Loveland and Cole Kmet. The receiver room, I think, is deeper than people were giving him credit for beforehand. It didn't quite work this time a year ago, but I don't think that was necessarily the wide receiver's fault. DJ Moore was kind of anonymous for most of the game, but we know he's a good player. I think they have a decision to make about whether they want to, you know, cash in on him. Maybe he's not a fit. They can turn it over to a guy like Luther Burden and, you know, expect him to be a starting player for this offense. Or if they want to just say, look, the depth is great, let's keep them all involved. We know DJ Moore can be a playmaker. Let's embrace the fact that we can be 3-4 guys deep. Zacchaeus was a big part in that practice and then was a big part in the game as well. He's a guy that consistently shows up everywhere he goes. He could be an underrated weapon for the offense. And then Luther Burden's just going to be such a fascinating playmaker. I mean, everybody's concerns about him at draft time were not really on the field related. It was, you know, attitude, it was want to, and yet we're seeing him go to work. We're seeing him get down and dirty in the red zone blocking, not, you know, making plays as a receiver. Obviously, he's got that talent. Everybody knows that, but he's doing the dirty work that's going to get him on the field to then get those catches, show that run after the catch stuff. So I think this is a really exciting group of playmakers for the quarterback to work with.
Highly motivated is what he looks like.
Yeah.
When you talk about Luther Burden III.
And that was the question to answer, right? Like, that was everybody's issue with him is, you know, is he going to want it enough to show this talent? Right now, he looks like he does.
Okay, so we've got the NFC North, which I think is the best division in the NFC. On the other side, I love the AFC North, and Layla's probably going to roll her eyes here, but that's okay. I have a question.
I'm smiling.
What do you say? I'm just saying, in anticipation, because you know where I'm headed. What do you think of the ceiling for the Pittsburgh Steelers with Aaron Rodgers as the quarterback?
I think the ceiling is Super Bowl, but I don't think it's necessarily because of Rodgers. I think that defense might be the number one defense in the NFL this year. That defense might be good enough to carry average offensive play to a Super Bowl. Like, that's how good I think that unit can be. So I don't even think Rodgers needs to play well for that team to be a Super Bowl contending team. If he does, gravy. It's, you know, it's added bonus on top of it. But that defense could be nasty.
You have to tell him now.
So I was ridiculed. I was harassed because I said.
By me.
When they signed Aaron Rodgers, I was like, oh, they have competent quarterback play. Not even great quarterback play, but a quarterback who is now 2 years removed from an Achilles injury.
Yeah.
As if you follow sports, you understand the second year back is always the year where you see what the player really is. Mike Tomlin's still the head coach.
Yeah.
Last I checked, he's never had a losing record, and that's been with some bad quarterback play. Tell me why their ceiling shouldn't be Super Bowl.
Agree.
And everyone just got on me. But I to have an expert like Sam, to come on our show and validate everything I've been saying, we're going to be running that back a lot.
I just said Ravens, Chiefs, and Bills might have something to say.
Absolutely.
About
it. Look, their ceiling is Super Bowl, but their floor, I think, is pretty low as well. Like, if the Rodgers thing implodes and it doesn't work well, and, like, not even on the field necessarily, but the personalities, you know, if him and Tomlin clash.
Absolutely.
The whole thing could implode and spiral out of control and blow up, and you might get the first losing season from Mike Tomlin. But absolutely, I think the ceiling could be Super Bowl.
Love it.
I think based on the potential, and you know coaches love potential, that's what it's all about for a lot of them. I feel like that's true. I do have a cognitive dissonance knowing the Ravens, Chiefs, and Bills exist.
Yeah, like they're not favorites or anything. You know, it would be tough, but we're talking about what's the best possible outcome for this team. I think the best possible outcome has to include the Super Bowl.
Okay, you're close to this situation. Trey Hendrickson, will he be a Cincinnati Bengal this season?
I feel like he has to be. It's such a mess. Like, it's such a preventable shoot-yourself-in-the-foot situation that they've gone through. But they have to get him in the building. Like, they can't trade him away now. That would be ridiculous. The time to do that was March, you know, not now when you can't do anything with the picks that you bring in. That's why, you know, the rumors were any trade deal has to involve a defensive player because you need something back. But, look, he's your best defensive player. You paid all the money to keep Joe Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins in the building. Like, you need the one good defensive star you have. Get him as well. Just get it done. You know, I understand it's tricky because at his age, you know, you're worried about when that decline starts to come for a pass rusher. But, you know, you just got to make it happen now.
We talked a lot last year, Sam, and we're talking to Sam Munson of the 33rd team. Happy to do so here on Raheem and Harris on the Score from Circa. So, Sam, I talked to you, I think we've talked a lot about, like, whether or not you think, for example, a ceiling like the Steelers is good, whether or not the NFC North is the best division in football. We said it a lot last year, and And then I reassessed after the playoffs. And I know that the Lions had so many injuries, you know, 16 players, I believe, on injured reserve off the top of my head last season. How do you think this shakes out now? Who do you think is the best division in football?
I think the contenders you just talked about are two of them. The Norths, both sides, AFC, NFC North, are two of them. The AFC West, I think, is probably going to put itself back in that conversation.
All right.
You know, the Chiefs are the Chiefs. The Jim Harbaugh-led Chargers last season showed they were moving in the right direction. The Broncos could be very good this year. And the Raiders, you know, they took a massive jump forward between Pete Carroll and Geno Smith. That's the two most important positions in that organization got massively better in the offseason. Maybe Geno Smith is, you know, there's a level to him that he's not, you know, he's not a Mahomes. He's not going to be in that elite tier, but he's good. And they haven't had good quarterback play in a while.
Yeah, his floor is high enough to see Pete Carroll do what he wants to do.
Right.
And especially when you look at who they have at running back now. I'm interested to see what that looks like with Ashton Jeanty.
Well, also, I think there's a reason he got comeback player of the year a couple years ago. I brought it up a lot just because Shane Waldron, you know, was the offensive coordinator last season. But I do feel that way. And I think, I don't know that you can say the exact same for a guy like Sam Darnold, for example. But you definitely have a example now when it comes to what a quarterback who was previously thought of as just serviceable can do on a really good team with a good coach.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, everyone's looking for the new Mahomes, right? The next Mahomes, the next superstar, the next guy that can do everything. But there's a whole world of quarterbacks in the NFL who belong in the NFL, who belong as starters, who are not Mahomes, but can still play really well if you give them a good enough situation around him. Whether it's, you know, you basically got three pillars, right? You've got the offensive line, you've got the receiving core, and you've got the coach. those are the three ways you can help a quarterback out. And if you have a situation where all three of those things are good, you can turn Sam Darnold into a guy that wins 14 games and, you know, looks like a star.
Imagine what you can turn the number one overall pick into when you have all three.
When you have
things.
An offensive line, a better receiving core, and a good coach, I feel like that
We're
might be happening.
About to find out.
Sam is going to be talking on part of a panel as well. He's part of Circa's Circa Football Preview panel on Saturday from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Pacific Time, Vegas time, here from the Galaxy Ballroom on Level 3 inside Circa Resort and Casino. Admission is free. It's free to hear the panel and hear Sam. Go to CircaVegas.com for more details. What can you tell us about that?
Very little, other than I'm on it and then we'll be talking.
I'll be answering questions.
You just get to cook.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're doing what you're doing here, for example.
They gave me the ask. I said, sure, no problem. And then I'm rocking up with the same as everyone else to find out what's going on Saturday.
Awesome.
Sounds like a good time. Stay out of the sun between now and then. How
Definitely.
About that?
Absolutely.
One hot minute. That's what Sam's got for the sun. Thank you so much for joining us, Sam. We always appreciate it.
No
Thanks,
problem.
Sam.
Thanks
appreciate it.
That's Sam Munson of the 33rd team. You know him as a constant guest on Raheemy and Harris on 670 The Score. We love having him. And he is waiting in the wings. I see him. I think he's got to take a victory lap on his predictions for at least last year's outcome.
Yeah.
Sean King, the QB, joins us next here from Circa on The Score.
First third down for Chicago. Third and five. Williams in. Rhythm again. There's Zacchaeus. And Olamide Zacchaeus takes it to the end zone for the Bears touchdown. 36-yard touchdown to finish off a 93-yard drive to start this game.
That was more from Fox Sports. We like to play the highlights of that game as we get you ready for a Bears game day coming up, by the way. Starters all in effect playing the Chiefs tonight. We are Raheemy and Harris. We broadcast live from our beautiful cabana here at Stadium Swim
at
Circa Resort and
great.
Casino in Las Vegas. Yeah, we got a ceiling fan. We got an air conditioning unit. And most importantly, we have Sean King in the house. You came all the way from your house to be with us in the cabana. At least we brought you some AC.
Well, I mean, anytime you get the chance to be in the presence of greatness, you know, you have to take advantage of that, right? Association breed assimilation. You hang around great, and then you start to take on the characteristics and attributes of that greatness. So,
yeah, we're hoping some of yours rubs off on us.
You're the Super Bowl champ.
Yeah.
We are not the Super Bowl champ. So I feel like that has to come from you to us, I feel like.
Well, first of all, I want to give a shout out to every fan that you guys have that jumped in my DMs.
Here we go.
My ex last year when I said drafting Caleb Williams over Jaden Daniels was a fire bullet fence by Ryan Poles, and I was berated and told that the Bears were a playoff team and that Caleb was going to compete for MVP. So I just want to, first of all, take a hat tip to everybody that was in my DMs.
Not the hat
and
tip.
I would expect those apologies sometime in the next 24 hours.
I don't think you're going to get as many apologies as maybe you are anticipating, but I will say this. The fireball fence to me wasn't necessarily drafting Caleb Williams because, you know, GMs make those mistakes all the time and can come back from them, see San Francisco. But I will say this. Not even scouting and interviewing Jaden Daniels, that is a problem.
So here's where you're wrong. There's nobody that knows what they're looking at that can evaluate Jaden Daniels' last 2 years of college and Caleb Williams' last 2 years of college and come away from that thinking that this prospect has a higher ceiling than this one. And I said that to say this. Jaden is box office. He was going to be box office no matter where he was drafted. But Caleb is talented. And I'm going to get into why I am actually buying Caleb Williams stock for 2025 moving forward.
We always buy low, though.
Did you hear that, everybody? Did you hear that, everyone, in Sean King's DMs? I feel like we have to subtitle it and put, like graphics on everything. He said this for a reason.
I did. And here's why I said Caleb was delusional coming out of USC. He had a big brand. He was a part of the initial NIL wave in college football. Him and his dad had convinced themselves that they were something unique to the National Football League. You saw it showcase itself this past draft with Shedeur Sanders. Mm. The NFL is the greatest thing attached to professional sports in the world. There are only 32 of these companies in the world. They have no competition. They have a full monopoly on everything. No matter how big of a brand you are in college, you're an employee when you get to the National Football League. And Caleb and his dad had to be humbled, and they were, because they failed. They tried to not go to the Bears. They ended up at the Bears. But Caleb is talented. And the reason I'm buying stock is because of Ben Johnson. He would never have succeeded under the previous regime. But Ben Johnson is a guy that comes in with enough cachet after what they accomplished in Detroit offensively to actually hold Caleb's feet to the fire. And what I saw in the preseason game was somebody's finally making him be accountable fundamentally. He threw the ball in rhythm. He threw the ball on time. He's always had the arm talent. He's always had the athleticism. But he's always gotten away with being talented, not being precise. And so you can see Ben Johnson's impact and effect already on Caleb, and I know that's going to manifest itself to him being a much better player, and it's going to enhance his opportunity to have a long career in this league.
Sean, I love that you're saying this, and especially on the back of what you have said previously about Caleb not being able to make the basic plays, the fundamental plays. Seeing Caleb in practice in training camp this year, my own two eyes, I was like, is there a reason why the only time Caleb seems to quote-unquote shine is in the two-minute drill portion of this practice when there is freelancing involved? There is having to kind of make your special way. But on the very basic, like, you're just supposed to hit this guy 2 seconds into, you know, dropping back. Mm-hmm. He's not doing it. I was like, Ben Johnson's trying to figure out what he can and cannot handle and making sure he can do the very basic stuff before we worry about any of that other stuff that made him so quote-unquote talented. And you're saying you're seeing in what we saw last week mm-hmm. in the preseason game that the fundamentals have been handled.
Absolutely. And he's been held accountable. And here's what's interesting. I view Ben Johnson in the same space that I view Sean Payton, I view Andy Reid, and I'm talking about the quarterback development part. These guys aren't just play callers. They aren't just brilliant offensive minds. I think Ben's in that group of guys that can also teach a quarterback that brilliance. There are a lot of coordinators in the National Football League who can go to a clinic and get on the board and X's and O's with the best of them.
Shane Walker.
But a lot of those guys don't know how to give that information to a quarterback in a way that it's simple. They can take it, make it practical on game day, and then if something's not right, explain to them how to fix it. And I think that's where Ben Johnson is elite, based on what I saw him do with Jared Goff and those guys in Detroit and what I've seen already in a small sample size with his impact on Caleb Williams.
Sean, as a former quarterback, who do you feel like helped you with that, or how do you feel like you got that for yourself?
Rich Rodriguez.
Yeah. My guy, Rich.
Yeah, Rich Rodriguez.
I covered him at West Virginia.
Shout out to Rich in the big city, Morgantown, West Virginia. Nobody thinks that. Nobody believes that. But I like to take shots at them every time I can.
I get it. I've been to Morgantown way too many times not to get what you just said.
But, I mean, he was considered, like, one of the original, like, embracers and architects of spread offense, which I feel like is still kind of the basis for what we're doing
And
here.
I got him out of Glenville State. When he came to Tulane, he came. Tommy Bowden was the head coach. He came from being the head coach at Glenville State. And I had already had really good fundamentals. There was Coach Johnny, was a guy in high school that made me, you know, really dive into that part of playing quarterback. It was all about the process. It wasn't the result. It was the process. It didn't matter if I completed the ball. It was the ball location proper. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't matter if the player was successful. It was the decision right? And so I grew up in that space. Caleb has grown up just being the best, the most talented. I don't have to worry really about processing it. I just run around. I'm faster than everybody.
Arm talent.
I got short area quickness. I can make all throws. And getting into this system with Ben, he's going to, first of all, start believing because he's going to see the results. And I think the Bears are going to get the best version of him. So Ryan Poles, as disgusted as I was with you last year for drafting Jaden Daniels, I think he hit the hammer right in the sweet spot of the nail with the Ben Johnson hire.
I feel like you've got a lot more cooking today. You're willing to hang out with us for another segment?
Yeah. And I like to hang around good people.
Sean King has decided to hang out for another segment. So we will do that more with the QB next from Vegas in the Cabana here on Raheemy and Harris. We're live from Circa Resort and Casino at Stadium Swim on 670 The Score.